loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced this morning that the United States would withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, a major arms control treaty with Russia, ending a cornerstone Cold War agreement by claiming that Russia has already violated it. The withdrawal takes effect in 6 months and threatens to set off a global arms race. Next, the Senate voted 68-23 yesterday to approve an amendment expressing strong opposition to President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria and to draw down the American presence in Afghanistan. The vote is veto-proof and is a direct challenge to the president's decision to bring the troops home. Then, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials admitted yesterday that they have been force-feeding 6 detained immigrants who went on a hunger strike to protest conditions at the Texas detention center where they are being held. A total of 15 immigrants are on hunger strikes, and most complain that they are being brutalized by ICE officers. And then, as preparations are underway for a historic second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un later this month, the United States may be softening its negotiating position in the hopes of reaching a deal. Meanwhile, the country's top intelligence officials told Congress earlier this week that North Korea likely will not give up its nuclear capabilities in an attempt to undermine these crucial upcoming talks. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and the just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the INF Treaty. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced this morning that the United States would withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, a major arms control treaty with Russia, ending a cornerstone Cold War agreement by claiming that Russia has already violated it. The withdrawal takes effect in 6 months and it threatens to set off a global arms race. We're joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. Welcome back, Greg. It's been a long time.
Great to be here.
Greg, what is the consequence of withdrawing from this agreement?
Let's see. I guess technically where the U.S. is suspending its participation in the treaty, but you know, this may be a distinction without a difference. As the Russians say, I think there's little doubt that the intent is to withdraw from the treaty. So getting past that, the consequences, you said?
Yeah, the consequences. What does it mean on a day-to-day basis?
It means the United States will feel free to pursue development of INF-violating missiles, which is something that many parts of the military and industrial complex and Congress have wanted to do for some time. There has been already a law passed requiring research into INF-violating missiles, but the extent to which that research has actually been done is still fairly black. Now, I think the lid can be taken off that, and the applicability of these missiles is often mentioned in the Western Pacific region.
Secretary of State said that the Russians have been violating this treaty since 2014. Is that true? Is that public? Has that been public knowledge? And during that same period, has the United States violated the treaty?
Well, there have been continuous assertions of Russian violation. And the U.S. didn't enhance the credibility of its accusations any by not saying exactly what those what the noncompliance was for years. And I think, wasn't it in 2017 that we finally named the missile? And Russia says, nope, that's not, we did not test this at INF violating ranges. And the U.S. said, yes, we did. Russia just had a show for military attachés showing the missile. And so I myself am agnostic and about this and ignorant. And I think that the United States has kind of been wanting to put pressure on Russia in this way and has not availed itself of the room to negotiate that we should have. It is possible, I could see it quite easily being the case that a missile test might have gone a little too far. It's pretty likely that in 30 years, missile technology has advanced some, and that it may be difficult to make a modern missile which approaches the maximum 500-kilometer range without also being capable of going farther. So, you know, technologically, there's a problem there, but I think that the bigger issues, and of course, the U.S. has these ambiguous missile launchers in Eastern Europe and Romania, which the Kremlin has pointed out. Why those couldn't be opened for inspection by Russia, I don't know that either. That would resolve that issue. So, you know, it just seems like we're intent on making this into as big an issue as we can because we want out of this treaty.
That's the voice of Greg Mello. Greg joins us from New Mexico. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. Greg Mello, you can certainly remember, and I do, and John, I think you will as well, that this agreement came about between Gorbachev, then leader of the Soviet Union, and Ronald Reagan, then president of the United States.
32 years ago.
Yeah, after millions of people, and I'm not exaggerating, millions of people literally had been in some kind of protest for several years, especially in Europe, but also here in the United States. There were a million people marched on June 12th, 1982 to Central Park. That was part of the movement that was generated in response to the U.S. placing intermediate range missiles all over Europe that targeted Soviet targets, and they were the political offices of the Soviet infrastructure, with missiles whose flight time, I think, was like 6 minutes or something like that. Very, very short. And the Soviets then, in response, targeted European capitals where these missile batteries were located. And as a consequence, Europe in particular said, well, if there's going to be a war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, we're going to get creamed. We're going to get demolished. We're going to be annihilated. And so it inaugurated this new peace movement that became global, but it was really anchored in Europe. The Russians are now saying, based on something I read, it was in the Western media, so it was a secondary source, but the Russians' position has been that if the U.S. abrogates or gets rid of this treaty and goes back to the old status quo, Russia will have no other choice but to begin targeting again European countries with also intermediate range or short range missiles. Again, a new arms race. Is that right?
Well, yes. Basically, there definitely is a new arms race. And if the United States placed intermediate range missiles in Europe, they would definitely need to be targets by Russia, would do that automatically. But of course, we have dual capable aircraft delivering soon to be ultra accurate tactical nuclear weapons from Europe. Presumably, those bases are already targets. And so, you know, I think that there's an aspect of this that is just bringing into light reality which has been existent all along, that we have the U.S. has nuclear weapons stationed in five European countries, and those are targeted. Russia has an enclave in Kaliningrad. And, you know, it's not a good situation overall. And there are forces in the U.S. government that are simply not content to allow Russia to have any sphere of influence or for Russian-European trade to grow. We have geopolitical designs in Eurasia, and allowing that much sovereignty to Russia or to China is not something that people are comfortable with in Washington.
Greg, the U.S. has in its nuclear arsenal land-based missiles. It has aircraft that you're mentioning. It also has submarines. There's the triad of sort of the three poles of the U.S. nuclear plan. Now the U.S. is also talking about outer space, and it seems to be a real thrust for the Trump administration. Is outer space the next battlefield? Is it the next sort of competition for the quote high ground?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. But I want to return to something you said just a second ago. The U.S. has intermediate range nuclear capable missiles, as does Russia. The difference being that we have a lot of them and we can deploy them all around Russia. There's sort of a, you know, basic difference between Russia, primarily a land power, and the U.S. With sea and air power, which is far more expensive to deploy at distance and in quantity. So the present situation, and the U.S. Has and is planning to greatly increase its intermediate range missiles and make them stealthy, but they would be launched from airplanes. They are and would be launched from airplanes and also from ships. So, you know, it's not a healthy situation all around. And focusing on the details of this violation is a way of not dealing with the broader strategic confrontation between the U.S. and Russia, which is really very bad.
Final question, 1 minute left, Greg Mello. When Trump was speaking yesterday, he announced that Pompeo would announce the suspension from the INF treaty by the United States, and that that would be then abrogated after 6 months. He said that NATO and the NATO countries fully support this decision. Now, those are the European countries. Again, it would seem to me that European political leaders would not be that thrilled about this. Anyway, is he right? Does the U.S. have NATO support?
No, he's not right. He's right in a way and not right in a way. No, they don't support it. The Europeans in general and political leaders would prefer to have the INF treaty, but what are they going to do about it? The European countries are just too passive, and they're all too willing to have U.S. write their security doctrines and place them in danger. And if they really don't want this treaty broken, they can do things. But do they have the courage?
That was the voice of Greg Mello, who joined us from New Mexico. Greg is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Senate voted 68-23 yesterday to approve an amendment expressing strong opposition to President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria and to draw down the American presence in Afghanistan. The vote is veto-proof and is a direct challenge to the president's decision to bring the troops home. We're joined from California by Cindy Sheehan. She's an anti-war activist and journalist whose son Casey was killed in the Iraq War. Welcome back, Cindy.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Cindy, 68-23 is indeed veto-proof. We don't know what the House is going to do, but what do you make of this decision of Democrats to join virtually unanimous Republicans in wanting to keep these wars going?
Well, of course, it's long been my position, and not just my position, but the position of many people, that when it comes to U.S. imperialism and the war machine, the Democrats are just the same, if not worse, than the Republicans. And what I found the most interesting thing about this vote was the Democrats who will be vying for the nomination in 2020, like Sanders and Harris and Cory Booker, they voted with Trump. And so to me, that's an interesting vote. What are they saying? Are they saying that they're actually for peace and they believe Trump is for peace? Or do they believe that their base is going to be energized by their no votes on this? So I think that out of that whole thing, I think that was an interesting aspect of the vote.
It is interesting. And I think it does reflect the fact that the Democratic candidates who are trying to win the nomination, who are trying to present themselves as progressives, can't really do that. And at the same time, support the endless deployment of American troops in military battle places, battlefields, in Afghanistan now going on 18 years, in Syria illegally. Again, it's a reflection of the base. And a lot of people sort of didn't really fully understand the Trump vote in the Midwest. Part of that vote was people who were sick and tired of the United States telling them that their children, and it's mainly working class kids who are in the military and who are being sent to these far off deployments, that there should be endless war. Trump sort of, even if it was demagogic, campaigned on that. I think that's popular.
Well, that's true. And they also saw the Democrat nominee, Hillary Clinton, as someone who was far worse and scarier. And besides the jobs, and they saw that the Clintons, you know, deported most of their jobs when Bill Clinton was president. But so, you know, it is true, but it's really interesting because the Democrats who are vying for 2020, they're vying to run against Trump, but then it's seen that they sided with Trump on this. So I'm not sure what, you know, who are they reaching out to on these votes? Because I don't believe they're votes of conscience. They have been, those three, especially the ones I mentioned, Booker, Harris, and Sanders, have been reliable votes for imperialism in the past.
Which is a real irony. I think this is something that most Americans, at least most Democrats, don't understand, that a lot of a lot of candidates, a lot of presidential candidates who purport to be progressives are reliable pro-war votes.
Well, if they're running in the Democrat Party, there's no doubt about that for sure. And so what we saw, especially with Trump's proposal to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, was many of the Democrats and liberals were adamantly opposed to that move, you know, saying that it's going to endanger, the U.S. and U.S. interests when, of course, we know that the U.S. doesn't have interests in other countries. Well, they have interests, but they don't have any business, economic interests in those countries. So we saw a lot of so-called liberals lining up against Trump and were very adamantly opposed to withdrawing troops from Syria. And it's just obvious. Somebody said, oh, look, now the Democrats, this is the thing. Now the Democrats are for sure the war party. And my question is, when have they not been the war party?
Cindy Sheehan is our guest. Cindy Sheehan is, of course, a legendary anti-war leader here in the United States. Cindy, one thing that has been big in the news this week is the fact that the U.S. government is apparently crafting or maybe crafting an arrangement with the Taliban, and the U.S. is not including the Afghan government, which has been the sole creation of the United States over the past 18 years since the invasion took place in October 2001. Again, not including the Afghan government. So now you have the Afghan government, ironically and weirdly, sort of having press conferences begging the American military to stay. Meanwhile, the U.S. doesn't, you know, even though this has functioned basically as a puppet government for the United States, sort of casting them aside or appearing to do so. And it says a lot about what the U.S. is actually doing in South and Central Asia and what its view is even towards its own allies. And I'm putting allies in with air quotes.
Air quotes, yep.
Well, also, we've seen some independent movement from Iraq, the puppet government in Iraq also. But the thing is about these proposed withdrawals from Afghanistan or Syria or whatever, they're not really withdrawals, they're just realignments. But we also saw that Bolton has a plan to send 5,000 troops to Colombia to put more pressure on the legitimate government there in Venezuela. So it's just moving these pawns all over the country and all over the world. And like you said, people in the Midwest and the Rust Belt and really all over, we're tired of having our children and our families and members of our community being used as those pawns just to be moved around the grand chessboard to put pressure on whatever, you know, democratically elected leader that the U.S. wants to put pressure on. And so, yeah, the vote yesterday in the Senate just demonstrated the fact that there's just one party, it's the war party, and it's going to take a mass movement of people, not just electorally here in the United States, not just saying we're voting for Trump because we hate Clinton, but really putting up a very legitimate and credible alternative to U.S. imperialism.
You know, this goes a little bit deeper than most of us realize, too. Remember, just a few weeks ago, the Senate defeated a measure that would have drawn down U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in their war in Yemen. So we can provide still whatever assistance we want to provide to perpetuate that war. There's an interesting bill in the House that's going to be considered next week that would bar the Trump administration from withdrawing troops from both Syria and South Korea.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
And so, that's also bipartisan.
It's also bipartisan.
You know, you can't get Congress to do a darn thing when it comes to helping people. But when
Amen.
when it's an effort to stop peace from breaking out anywhere in the world, it's sort of like they're to the barricades. It's really said something. We have talked so much, Cindy Sheehan, about the imperial presidency. And of course, it is an imperial presidency, regardless of who's in it. But we have an imperial Congress. And in some ways, when the imperial president starts to move a little bit in the direction of anything that even smacks of not peace, but something in that direction, it becomes alarming to the Imperial Congress.
Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned we can't get them to do anything for the people. It's extraordinary that there are people all over this country dying of they're freezing to death because they don't have homes. They can't get in shelter. And it's just appalling that in this country, with all the resources, and they're all allocated towards imperialism and not to social programs. And yeah, it's just really extraordinary. And it is criminal. And every person that dies from freezing to death during this horrible winter, that's a murder. That's a murder.
It's exactly the word I used on Facebook. That's right. It's a murder.
Yeah. We can attribute it to U.S. imperialism.
Yeah. And Cindy is right, John. I mean, yeah. Here you have, I mean, what a spectacle. We have the polar vortex, have all these people in freezing, I mean, sub-freezing conditions, lots of homeless people, lots of homeless people. People are dying, have been dying this week. So what does the U.S. Congress leap into action for to make sure that U.S. troops say don't come out of Syria, which, by the way, is completely against law, international law. Against the UN Charter, it's not the U.S. troops are not there at the invitation of the Assad government or authorized by the UN Security Council. The U.S. government is a signatory to the UN Charter, which means that that treaty is the highest law of the land. Again, Congress violating international law, ignoring the homeless to make sure that the U.S., the permanent warfare state, stays just as it is.
Yeah, I fear that with this like-mindedness in both the House and the Senate, we're not really going to see anything in
Well, that's why people like Cindy Sheehan, who has been organizing people have to move.
Yeah, we've got to keep up the fight. Well, we were joined from California by Cindy Sheehan. She's a legendary anti-war activist and journalist whose son Casey was killed during the Iraq War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by my co-host, John Kiriakou. Immigrations and custom enforcement officials admitted yesterday that they have been force-feeding 6 detained immigrants who went on a hunger strike to protest conditions at the Texas Detention Center where they are being held. A total of 15 immigrants are on hunger strikes, and most complain that they are being brutalized by ICE officers. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz. Mr. Ruiz is the co-founder of the New Sanctuary Movement. Juan Carlos, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. It's good to be here.
So here we have immigrant prisoners who are being treated badly, so badly that they have gone on a hunger strike to try to change their conditions. And instead of addressing the conditions, instead of spending the resources to deal with the conditions that are the underlying point of protest, it appears that ICE is basically torturing these prisoners by force feeding them. Is that what's happening?
Yes. So we've been decrying this for years, you know, that the conditions in these gulags, in these Guantanamos across the nation have been deteriorating, you know. So this is not a new thing for us, but this clearly evidences a system that basically attempts, you know, threatens any kind of human life. And the basic human rights of people who are being detained, we have to remember, you know, that the conditions exist, given that there is not much monitoring. Given that all these detention centers, most of them, the majority of them, are in private hands, that is, private companies with little to not monitoring, are housing, if housing is, I don't think is the adequate word, but it's they have in these places of torture these individuals. So what we are seeing, you know, that the decrying of these conditions is not new. But it really emphasizes a system that has really turned against our communities, turned against people of color across the nation. So we, you know, I mean, we appeal to all people with good conscience and good faith, you know, to raise their voices, to decry such injustice, And really, I think, you know, when we talk about this privatization of jails, of detention centers, you know, this is clear evidence that this is well entrenched in our justice system, which doesn't have much room for justice, and we do need to do something about it.
Yeah, we're talking with Juan Carlos Ruiz about the force feeding of hunger strikers who are being held in ICE detention facilities. 11 detainees refusing food, some of them for more than a month. I mean, people don't do this, Juan Carlos. People do not starve themselves nearly to death. And especially when you're on a hunger strike for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you're starting to risk organ damage, long-term damage, even if you go off the hunger strike. People don't do that unless their conditions are so bad, so severe that they feel desperate. Because again, when you're doing a hunger strike, and I want to ask our audience to think about this, you're already in a detention center, you're not in your own country, you don't know what's going to be happening, you don't know how long you're going to be held, you go on a hunger strike, you don't even know really whether people are going to know that you're on a hunger strike or know about it in large enough quantities of people so that their intervention will make a difference. It's a kind of a desperation act, and yet we have the authorities treating them as if this is one more crime they're committing against America.
Yeah, and you know, Brian, I think I do not use Guantanamo to call these places, you know, the Guantanamos that we have in our nation, throughout our nation. I don't use it, you know, lightly. I think they have become places, given the, once again, like 75% of these detention facilities are in the hands of private companies. You know, they are making a kill. They are making a lot of money, and a lot of the work they do, you know, this infrastructure is that of terror and torture. The conditions that they are providing for the people that keep being incarcerated in this legal limbo, I mean, it's just for the sake of the profit. We know that the regular folk that is in jail gets to pay, you know, between 75 to 120 per day. You know, people who are on immigration detentions, they get a 40% more, that has to be paid. And so we're talking about, you know, an increase of $90 to $150 per day. So, you know, this is a booming business, given that the political climate that has been created, you know, fosters and festers this kind of, the imprisonment and the putting away of thousands upon thousands of people. Now, we have to remember also that methodically and systematically, people are being cut off from any kind of community resources, legal resources, so that they are being held in these places indefinitely. When I do say Guantanamo, it's not a rhetoric figure, but it's something that is taking place, you know, in our backyard.
That's the voice of Juan Carlos Ruiz. Juan Carlos Ruiz is the co-founder of the new sanctuary movement. These prisoners, some of them are being held in the El Paso Processing Center, or that's where they were taken into custody. Four others are in ICE detention centers across the country, one each in Miami, Phoenix, San Diego, and San Francisco. So this is a nationwide hunger strike. Juan Carlos, I was looking at some numbers the other day, and I thought of this because, you know, when a story becomes news, when the media, the corporate-owned mainstream media focuses on it, all of our attention goes to that story. And then we think about it, we're concerned about it, and then a couple of days later, or even sometimes just a day later, that story is replaced by some other big story, some other sensational news. And the thing that was big last week or big 2 days ago becomes nothing. It becomes like a non-issue. And in a way, we start to all of us become desensitized or inured from understanding the significance of these ongoing stories. And the reason I'm mentioning it, we were all focused on the children who were being taken into custody at the border before. There were big demonstrations. massive demonstrations all around the country, and then the news media refocuses and we stop thinking about them. I saw a number the other day that the United States government has as many as 15,000 children in custody in the United States. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is right, Brian. These are the so-called unaccompanied minors that in the last few years. I mean, there are some children that who have been locked away for 2-3 years, you know, without any kind of solution in the near future. So we are talking about kids who have been forced, displaced from their hometowns and coming, you know, to this site. And most of them have family, most of them have friends waiting for them. But, you know, there is this kind of violent cycle that if people begin to claim them, they have to identify themselves. And given the political climate nowadays, you know, a lot of them fear once they identify themselves to claim these kids, they are going to be targeted by the administration, by ICE, you know, and that's been the case in many instances. So we have, you know, in Tornillo, Texas, we have these gulags. Once again, these Guantanamos. I do believe that the number is greater than 15,000, but there is a censorship to journalists, investigative journalists, you know, to look into these spaces. So there is a humanitarian crisis that we have in our hands, that we have been created.
Juan Carlos Ruiz, we have 1 minute left. The other story I was noticing the other day is how ICE arrests at the New York City courthouse have gone up so stupendously. People are coming to be witnesses, sometimes in domestic abuse cases, sometimes in trafficking cases, sometimes they're accompanying a family member. And ICE is all around these courthouses swarming on people. So the rate of arrests at courthouses is like 1,700% greater than it was, say, in 2016. Again, this would seem to me to be facilitating not just the arrest of people, but causing great fear among immigrant families if they want to come and, say, report a crime or be a witness to a crime. How does that in any way, shape, or form offer protection to anybody when you're criminalizing people who are making appearances at courthouses?
Yeah, you know, it is erosion of the civil rights of any person. Because right now, you know, like yesterday, a friend of mine, well, somebody called me on the phone and he was a victim of aggression, you know, violence. And he was saying that he had to go and testify against the assailants, you know, who were shouting racial. It's a crime of hate. So he was told by the lawyer, but, you know, when you come in and testify against them, you might get arrested. So he basically was contemplating, you know, just fleeing because he said that he was afraid. I mean, and this is kind of an erosion of, you know, the democratic values, the value of justice, just on all fronts.
Yeah, it is a drastic erosion. It may be an assault on basic rights. We were joined from New York City by Juan Carlos Ruiz. Juan Carlos Ruiz is the co-founder of the New Sanctuary Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. As preparations are underway for a historic second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un later this month, the United States may be changing its negotiating position in the hopes of reaching a deal. Meanwhile, the country's top intelligence officials told Congress earlier this week that North Korea will likely not give up its nuclear capabilities in an attempt to undermine these crucial upcoming talks. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Tim Shorrock, Tim is a Washington-based investigative journalist who grew up in Japan and South Korea and who is the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. His work has appeared in many publications in the United States and abroad, including The Nation and others. Tim Shorrock, welcome back.
Thank you.
These are exciting times when it comes to the prospect of peace possibly breaking out on the Korean Peninsula. Let's just talk about the announcement that soon, maybe in the coming days, there will be the date and the location announced for a second summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. And also what appears to be a shifting position from the Trump administration regarding its approach to these negotiations.
Well, it's very interesting that, you know, they've announced that the second summit will happen soon by the end of February. And it shows that, you know, over the last few months, there's been a lot of, you know, give and take between the U.S. and the North Korean side. And at first, you know, the talks had been, you know, basically between the intelligence chiefs, but they've clearly moved, you know, to the diplomatic phase, as we saw from the recent visit about 2 weeks ago of, you know, Kim Jong-un's representatives to Washington, and where they met with Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo and the special representative for Korea, North Korea, Stephen Bagan. You know, and the North Korean delegation was filled with people that have, you know, diplomatic experience and also experience dealing with U.S., you know, U.S. officials as well as U.S. NGOs and peace groups. So, you know, like they're really, you know, getting down to the nitty gritty now. So I think definitely progress has been made behind the scenes, and you know that's what they're hoping for in this next round. But I think, you know, there's going to be a meeting in early February in Panmunjom, as I understand it, between the special representative Stephen Bagan and a Korean delegation led by its former North Korea ambassador to Spain, who's now, you know, a close diplomatic advisor to Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. So, well, I think with those talks, you know, scheduled, they're going to iron out, you know, what comes up in the what they really will get to in the upcoming summit.
Tim Shorrock is our guest. We're talking about the possibility of a second summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal from today, Tim. I'll read the second paragraph to you. Stephen Bagan, the State Department Special Representative for North Korea, indicated in a speech that the U.S. is no longer insisting that Pyongyang provide a detailed accounting of its nuclear and missile programs at the start of the denuclearization process, but can do so later in the talks. That seems significant to me.
Very significant, because from the beginning, even the U.S. side has been insisting that there has to be a full denuclearization before anything happens in terms of sanctions or anything else. And, you know, now they're saying, you know, okay, you know, you take a step, we'll take a step. You take a step, we'll take a step. And this is really the process that's been encouraged by South Korean President Moon Jae-in and his government, which has taken exactly the same approach with the DPRK. And I think it's been, you know, the DPRK is very been made it very clear that they would like to see, you know, some moves made on lifting some of the sanctions, you know, in a step-by-step way as they make their own move. And so I think, you know, that's what he's talking about. But it's a very significant shift, and I think kind of an acceptance of, you know, the reality of the situation, because, you know, it was really foolish, and it still is foolish for people and analysts here in Washington to demand that, you know, they give up all their weapons, all their deterrence, you know, before the U.S. does anything. I mean, they created this, you know, nuclear force, and they're, you know, built missiles because they believe that, you know, there's a very serious threat from the U.S., which is well armed with nuclear weapons and has nuclear weapons pointed at them, you know, in the Asia region. And so they're not going to disarm without a sense that their country is safe from, you know, U.S. attack, U.S. intervention. And so that's why this step-by-step process is so important. And I think, you know, it's starting, you know, we will see, but I think it's going to start to bear fruit.
Tim Shorrock, again, looking at this Wall Street Journal article, I want to read a little bit more from it to you and get some additional comments, again, along on the same theme, actually. Here it is, quote, "The Trump administration's pragmatic approach to talks with North Korea, a step-by-step process which includes benefits for both countries, appears to be making important progress in achieving denuclearization," close quote, said Joel Witt, a former State Department official involved in North Korean negotiations. Mr. Witt added, quote, "Chairman Kim's commitment to dismantle and destroy facilities that produce material for nuclear bombs, if implemented, would cap its arsenal and set the stage for reductions and eventual elimination." Now, there's a lot there that, again, we want to sort of unpack for our audience that may not be following this story in the ins and outs. But what that suggests is that the United States position now is not even actually about denuclearization in the immediate future, but a recognition that North Korea is a nuclear power and that the goal, if implemented, as it said, would be to cap its arsenal and set the stage for reductions and eventually elimination. Now, when you look at the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty from 1969, that's basically the deal for all nuclear powers is to cap nuclear programs. In other words, don't keep expanding them, and start to eventually and incrementally take steps to reduce and then eliminate them entirely. That seems to be, in a way, a de facto acceptance, perhaps, that North Korea, at least in the near term, is a nuclear power.
Well, in the near term, it definitely is. I mean, they're recognizing the reality of the situation. But the other part of the reality of the situation is that, you know, it's important to remember that, you know, a year ago, Kim Jong-un and they declared, you know, no more testing. And, you know, they had stopped short of putting a weapon on a missile and testing it and having it go through the atmosphere. So they never got to that step. So they are a de facto nuclear power. They do have nuclear weapons, but they still don't have the full delivery system to fire those weapons and you know, lob them somewhere, you know, whether it's Japan or anywhere, South Korea, United States. They don't have that ability yet. So, you know, them stopping the testing was very critical to even getting these talks going. So, yes, it is a recognition of that. And I think it's also a recognition of, you know, what the North Korean side has been saying, you know, since in the first 2 points of the agreement of the discussions they had in Singapore were that, you know, the U.S. would move to basically, you know, build new relationship with North Korea. North Korea wants an entirely different relationship with the United States, and that's what it's been pushing for, a non-belligerent relationship, a friendly relationship where we can, you know, the North Korea and the United States can coexist. And that was, you know, they've been pushing this and saying this, you know, since June, last June, they've been saying, look, you know, we don't think you're moving toward, you know, building a new relationship. And look, without that relationship, they're going to keep their nuclear force. And so I think as this relationship evolves, and, you know, they're going to clearly make some concessions at the next summit, and, you know, it may be closing down this Yongbyon facility where a lot of the plutonium is made and also where uranium is enriched, because they also have a major uranium facility there. And, you know, stopping that or dismantling that would be a huge step. So, you know, yes, I agree. It's a sort of de facto recognition of them as a nuclear state, but they're not quite, you know, a full-fledged nuclear state. That also must be kept in mind.
Indeed, those are important points. And I'm so glad you went back to the Singapore summit. The U.S. mainstream media was ridiculing the summit and its declaration for, quote, being short on specifics. Of course, it is short on many, many specifics. It's a short document. But the fact that, as you pointed out, point number one wasn't about nuclear weapons at all. It was about let's improve relations as the demand of or the aspirations of the people from both countries. That was number one. And number two was setting up a peace mechanism on the Korean Peninsula. And then only number three did denuclearization come into the picture as part of that agreement. And again, the North Koreans have been waiting for the U.S. to make some measurable step towards improving relations. We could be on the verge of something. Tim Shorrock, we have 1 minute left. I noticed that Steve Begun also said in his speech, we won't lift sanctions until denuclearization is complete. But then he added, quote, We didn't say we won't do anything until you do everything. Again, that would be an indicator that the U.S. might be about to shift or could potentially shift in terms of its sanctions position, no?
Right. There's different sanctions that have been imposed by both the U.S. and the United Nations. And so, you know, some of them could be lifted, like they could lift the sanction on oil imports, for example, which is clearly hurting the North Korean economy. They could do it in step by step. So I think that's what he's talking about. But the other thing important that he said was Trump wants to end the war. So I think, you know, a formal declaration of the end of the Korean War would be, you know, a great thing. And that's actually one of the things I'm really hoping for out of this next summit, something that's really wanted by both North and South Korea.
Indeed. That's the linchpin. Okay, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from Washington, D.C. by Tim Shorrock, a Washington-based investigative journalist. He grew up in Japan and South Korea. He's the author of numerous books and articles, including the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. His work has appeared in many publications in the United States and abroad, including The Nation magazine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again, this week, we take a look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And you can also find the worst headlines that we don't have time to get to today. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we're also joined here in the studio by Nicole Roussel. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks so much.
Hi, everybody.
Steve, you sent over a headline that you called the headline of the week, and it really is, to me, the funniest headline of the week. Why don't we start with that?
Yeah, I just wanted to give a shout out. We're usually beating up on the mainstream media. This is not the mainstream media, but it was a headline I love from Mint Press News. Donald Trump's Axis of Evil, Pompeo, Bolton, and Abrams.
Spot on.
Shout out to whoever wrote that headline.
It's the troika of tyranny.
It is. It is indeed.
The real troika of tyranny.
They would have added Pence, but there's no word for four in troika, so they didn't know the Russian word for that, so they had to stick with three people.
Okay, well, let's get back to the corporate-owned media, which we want to beat up on, because not because we want to beat up on them, but they just deserve it.
They really do.
Exactly, and the first one comes from the Washington Post, and this was the jaw-dropping headline of the week. The GOP has become the Soviet Party.
Oh, my gosh.
It's just astonishing how the mainstream media and politicians just can't seem to keep the distinction clear between the Soviet Union and Russia, despite the fact that the Soviet Union ceased to exist more than a quarter of a century ago. It's really pretty bizarre.
But explain that. Why is it the Soviet Party? What do they mean?
Well, really, they mean it's the pro-Russia party, and because GOP backs Trump, who loves Putin and Russia, according to the media. And the evidence for that is rather opposite, let's just say, and you've covered that well, and we won't talk about that. And the other aspect of that is they basically say that under the USSR, workers suffered because they stood in bread lines. That's kind of the line. And now workers are suffering because it was during the shutdown that they wrote this article. You know, minor details like the fact that the USSR had universal health care and free education and a planned economy and all sorts of things that the GOP absolutely opposes. It just doesn't seem to matter to the Washington Post.
Here's from the piece. Once upon a time, Ayn Rand reading, red-baiting Republicans denounced Soviet Russia as an evil superpower intent on destroying the American way of life. My, how things have changed. The grand old party, GOP, has quietly become the pro-Russia party. And not only because the party's standard bearer seems peculiarly enamored on Russian President Vladimir Putin. Under Republican leadership, the United States is starting to look an awful lot like the failed Soviet system the party once stood united against. Now, wait a second. Is Trump pro-Russia? I mean, last night, he announced that the U.S. was canceling the Intermediate Nuclear Range Missile Treaty, the INF, a cornerstone of the end of the Cold War, the agreement between Reagan and Gorbachev. Is Trump pro-Russia when he sends weapons to Ukraine to fight against Russia? Is he pro-Russia when they set up missile defense shields in Romania and Poland? Is he pro-Russia when they've evicted Russian diplomats and imposed new sanctions? When Trump imposes and threatens new sanctions against Germany if they indeed get Nord Stream 2, in other words, their natural gas from a cheaper source, that would be Russia. How does that amount to a pro-Russia policy? I'm sorry, Rachel Maddow, but I just don't get it. How is that pro-Russia?
That requires too much thought.
It's not.
Okay, that's let's go answer. On to another story.
In case your listeners were confused, this was not a Rachel Maddow article, although she undoubtedly would agree with it. Well, sticking with Russia, the next article from the New York Times was the most misleading headline of the week. Trump and his associates had more than 100 contacts with Russians before the inauguration.
Ooh.
Okay. First of all, the basic misdirect in this headline is the reader is supposed to think that Russians is the same thing as Russian government, which is not true in most of these contacts. Had nothing to do with Russians, with the Russian government, rather. But the real misleading part is when you read the article, it wasn't Russians. It was Russians, WikiLeaks, who they equate with Russians, which on no grounds whatsoever, or also their quote-unquote intermediaries. And by the way, they also include in these 100 contacts people who, quote unquote, were told about the interactions but did not have any themselves. So talk about inflating a number and trying to, you know, build up your case when it's much weaker than, you know, than it really is. It's just disgusting that they do that.
You know, this is a kind of it's equivalent to racism in a way, because against Russians. I mean, of course, in America, racism is associated with white supremacy.
But it's certainly bigotry.
The Russians are a multinational state. But anything, meaning they're not simply white people, they're all kinds of nationalities. During the Soviet era, there were more than 100 nationalities in the Soviet Union. They spoke many, many different languages, had different cultures, et cetera, et cetera. But it is kind of a bigotry.
It is. It's bigotry.
It's a form of bigotry against Russia and Russians as an ethnicity.
But we've always been like that. We always need to have this enemy that our government makes us rally against.
Yeah, in World War II, it was the yellow peril, the Japanese.
Exactly.
So Japanese people were carted off to concentration camps, or Muslims, who, as our guest Nazia Kazi said this week, there's a racialization now of Muslims, even though Muslims come from all parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, go ahead, Steve. Let's keep moving.
Let's go on to the Not the Onion headline of the week from the Washington Post. Rubio disputes that the United States would participate in a coup in Venezuela.
What?
Somebody forgot to tell Rubio that it was our coup.
I mean, you can't believe some stuff you read, but there it was. And there it is.
Yeah. By the way, Rubio, we mentioned this earlier, Rubio in one of his tweets earlier in the week, because he's talking to rich Venezuelans in Florida, where he's the senator, and they're saying, go for it, Marco. Let's get our oil back. Let's take back all of these things that have been sort of apportioned for poor and working class people and social programs. Let's get it back. And so they're loving him. And so he's quoting the Bible, the Old Testament, Isaiah, I think it's Isaiah 61, about himself. The Lord has sent me. The Lord has anointed me.
I told you last week, this is a guy who's had four different religions so far in his lifetime.
Yeah. Well, now he's the Lord of one of them.
He's the messenger of the Lord. Let's keep going.
The next article is from Lawfare Blog. And before we get to the headline, I just want to make a general point about this. You know, generally we concentrate on the corporate mainstream media. And you might say, well, Lawfare Blog, what's that? I personally, I don't read it, never really heard of it. But the thing is, in this day of social media and virality, articles from really any source can become important. So this article, for example, showed up on my Facebook page posted by a friend of mine, and he undoubtedly, because he's not a lawyer, I'm sure he read it from somewhere else and so on. So the need to analyze headlines is actually much wider these days because of social media than it ever was when it was dominated by the mainstream media. Anyway, here's the headline finally. Roger Stone's arrest was appropriate, not heavy-handed. Now, of course, we remind listeners that this was an arrest pre-dawn, 12 armed cops showing up at the door of this guy.
I thought it was 28.
Was it?
I think that's what he claimed. Who knows?
Yeah, that's what he claimed.
Oh, it was a Roger Stone number.
I think that was a Roger Stone number.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, he had no criminal record. He was charged with basically a white-collar crime. And they claim, this article says, it was perfectly appropriate because he was a danger, because he had threatened some witness in an email saying, prepare to die.
Randy Credico.
Randy Credico's dog, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that he was a flight risk. And yet the same day they released him. So he couldn't have been much of a danger or a flight risk if they released him the same day.
This wasn't a headline about that story. But one thing, yeah, they all came in, John, as you've talked about, FBI, they came in full military regalia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Roger Stone showed up at the door in his bathrobe. But here's another thing. CNN was there with a camera crew.
Oh, yes.
How did they find out? They said they put two and two together. But do you think that the Mueller investigation or somebody in that thing like leaked to CNN?
So absolutely.
6 a.m. in the morning, they're outside Roger Stone's apartment to get the shot?
Because they had a premonition that the FBI is going to show up.
Yeah, let's just keep this camera crew there forever and because someday Roger Stone will be arrested. Anyway, that's not a headline, but it was a weird part of the story.
It was.
We don't have much time, Steve. 1 minute left.
Here's a gross misleading headline from Newsweek. Two nuclear-capable Russian aircraft entered American airspace before being intercepted by U.S. And now here's the first sentence of the article. Two nuclear-capable Russian aircraft encroached close to American airspace on Friday.
Also meaning international airspace. Also known as international airspace.
What a non-story that is. Oh my gosh.
But they're in the headline. They entered American airspace. I mean, it's just a deliberate misrepresentation of what happened in the headline and for obviously deliberate reasons to make things sound bad.
Okay, last story, 30 seconds.
Last headline. From BBC, Venezuela crisis. White House will respond to threats against diplomats.
What threats against diplomats?
There were no threats against the diplomats made by Venezuela. In fact, this headline is a threat against Venezuela.
The Trump administration and Pompeo in front of the OAS said Maduro is no longer president of Venezuela. We've already toppled him. We announced that there's a new guy who's the president. So when Maduro said the U.S. and Venezuela were breaking diplomatic relations and American diplomats had to leave, Pompeo and Trump said he doesn't have the authorization because we just told you he's no longer president. And then they said, and if he does evict the diplomats or even suggest that he might, that's a threat to American diplomats. Again, Alice in Wonderland, upside down.
It sure was. Well, we're out of time. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And you can also find there the worst headlines that we didn't have a chance to get to. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we were also joined in studio by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Love, love, love.